I am a person in long-term recovery.
Okay.
My drug of choice was heroin, and I also, cocaine would have definitely been runner-up.
Okay.
And I come from a long line of alcoholics and addicts. My mother, her family, Irish Catholic, there was eight of them.
Oh, boy.
And you know, my father, Italian-American, and he also, there was also eight siblings.
Wow.
So, unfortunately, many of my maternal aunt and uncles and my paternal aunt and uncles have gone down the path of addiction. So while I was growing up, it was normal behavior.
Okay.
And beyond just living in that environment where being intoxicated was normal, there were other things, other risk factors as well. My father, who is also an alcoholic, was also a criminal.
Okay.
So he was in and out of prison my entire life. He went to prison for the first time when he was 19 years old. And he has not been able to remain outside of the penitentiary, but for, I think, a few years he had, 2 years since then. And my mother, she was always removed from me while I was growing up. But that was the first risk factor, not having a father in the home to provide that unconditional love that really gives a little girl self-esteem. My mother pretty much had to work two jobs most of my childhood and adolescence to make ends meet. So when she did come home, she wasn't very engaged with me. She's a very depressed person.
Okay.
And, you know, she would basically just go to her room and, you know, read and go to bed. And, you know, that is what I remember the most about my childhood and adolescence was really my mother always being in this room and never engaging. When I was about 8 years old, right around that time, I started finding like bottles of vodka in our jukebox or, you know, bottles of rum, you know, somewhere in the vehicle. And I wasn't aware at the time that my mother was falling into alcoholism, you know, at that level. But I do know that as the years went by, that it did get progressively worse, and it did become much more noticeable. My grandparents were an incredibly stabilizing factor in my life.
Okay.
Because my mother was a single mother, they pretty much raised me. They, you know, we lived with my grandparents until I was 12 years old. Neither of my grandparents, you know, drank or did drugs. My grandfather, he stopped drinking in his 40s because of a heart attack. So the stability that that home provided me, I believe very much, is what allowed me to develop a lot of characteristics that would eventually see me through my addiction.
Okay.
The stability of that home and the love that my grandmother and my grandfather gave to me. So when I was 12 years old, my mother, I went to junior high. It was a huge transition because the junior high school that I transitioned to was big. It was 1,200 kids.
Oh, man.
So I went, you know, from being in elementary school to making this huge transition to middle school. And I was already lacking a lot as far as self-esteem went. And there's something critical about our relationship with either parent being disrupted and, you know, neglect, you know, not having that parent with you, you know, is just as influencing as being around them every day and it being dysfunctional.
Sure.
So when I went into middle school, my mother was falling deeper into her alcoholism, and she had also met a man at work. And he, you know, sold drugs. Mm-hmm. He sold prescription pills, and he sold marijuana, and he was also an alcoholic. And over this one summer, you know, she had been dating him all through that winter before I went into junior high school. But then that summer, she had moved in with my aunt with him. So I didn't see her very much at all the summer before seventh grade.
Okay.
And she married him. She married him unbeknownst to me. So we were at a family reunion in Ypsilanti, and she basically told me there that she had been married. And
oh, my goodness.
I was devastated because they told me I was moving in with them.
Wow.
And that, you know what I mean, before school started, that, you know what I mean, they were purchasing a home and, you know, it was going to be one big happy family. Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't. It wasn't at all, because I got uprooted from my grandmother's home that had always been a very safe haven for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was now living with two full-blown alcoholics. And, you know, there was continuous traffic in the house because of the drug dealing. And life, you know, whatever kind of issues I was having that I was not aware up until that point, my whole world just, you know, got flipped upside down.
Right.
And I just started acting out in a number of ways. You know, I, you know, started having sex very early. I started experimenting with marijuana and alcohol. And my grandmother was getting very, very sick.
Mm-hmm.
So she was always, you know, she was my mother.
Right.
She was my mother.
Stability.
Yes. And she wasn't capable of, you know, overseeing me and guiding me and being there for me as she had been during my childhood. So I got lost. I got completely lost. And as my mother dived deeper and deeper into her alcoholism and, you know, chaos was in my household,
mm-hmm.
it just got deeper and deeper for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was about 14, I started running away from home. I just didn't want to be there. It was a complete hellhole to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one time I was gone for like 2 weeks, and I was put on probation. And I remember going into the courtroom. They were talking about putting me in placement. And I told the judge in front of my mother and my stepfather, I said, he sells drugs, and I... You know what I mean? Do not want to go back there.
Mm-hmm.
I do not want to go back to that household. And for whatever reason, I did go back there when I got out. Yeah, when I got out of juvenile, you know what I mean? I went back to that house.
Wow.
And I just found different ways to escape my life because I hated it. And
mm-hmm.
as my peers continued to, you know, develop and advance and hit their milestones, and I didn't, you know, there just more shame developed. I bowed out of life a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And the drug club is the club everybody gets into.
Mm-hmm.
So being that identity and peers are so important during that time,
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, I found those unhealthy peer groups.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my way of coping and feeling solidarity with someone.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody that I ran with from that time on was somebody that was in the same boat as myself.
Mm-hmm. I can feel your story so far. I'm right there with you.
Yes. And so there were some really good things, though. There were some really good things. My mother, before she, you know, before she let her depression bring her, you know, to her own alcoholism and just destruction, when I was a little child, she did some things for me that I will always be grateful for, because she was an adamant reader, and she spent a lot of time with me when I was a baby, and she put me in Montessori school when I was 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So I could read by the time that I was four. And I was always an inquisitive child, and I had a thirst to learn things. And so I am grateful for my mother giving me that early education, because I believe that my intelligence was also a resiliency factor that allowed me to get to the other side of this.
Okay.
So I was always a bright girl, and, you know, I pretty much bowed out of school at 14 or 15. And when I eventually got through all of my hell with my addiction and picked back up in college, it was no big deal for me.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, had all kinds of fears there. But so at 16 years old, I met a boy, and, you know, they're like drugs too. And he wasn't good for me. You know, he was a lot, he was, you know, he had really no business being with me. He was 22 years old, and I was 16, and he had all kinds of issues of his own, and he had his own dependency issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very much, you know what I mean, in love with him, as in love with someone as a 16-year-old can be from that
mm-hmm.
perspective.
Yeah, but it was real at the time.
Absolutely. I was completely obsessed with him. You know, I would have stopped doing drugs or done anything. But he was also an addict, and we drank a lot together, and he actually turned me on to heroin.
Okay.
And so I did heroin for the first time with him when I was 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I also smoked crack cocaine for the first time at 16 years old.
Okay.
And I was so into him that I didn't just fall right off the cliff with heroin and cocaine or any other drug for that matter at that time. Because, you know, my main drugs at that time were fantasy, not dealing with reality.
Mm-hmm.
And him, which he was a big part of that.
Sure.
So I just kind of, you know, focused entirely on him for the next 2 years. And
okay.
I ended up getting pregnant with my son.
Okay.
And I was happy about that. You know, I was happy because I was so insecure in myself that I wanted to latch myself onto another human being. And that's the perfect way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of young girls fall into that same dangerous fantasy.
Yeah.
So we had a baby, and his parents had a house that had been given to them from his grandparents, and they allowed us to stay there. And for a minute, we just played house.
Okay.
And, you know, it was okay for a minute. But it wasn't too long after the baby was born, you know, and I managed not to do, you know, any drugs or anything throughout that pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
But right after the baby was born, you know, we fell right back into the pattern of partying all the time. And when I look back on that time of my life, as much as I would never, you know, ever go back in time and not have my son, I know that I was not old enough to have a child.
Mm-hmm.
I was not educated enough to have a child. I was not mature enough to have a child. And so we broke up when my son was 18 months old.
Okay.
And I got an apartment, and I just kind of fell apart. I was working. I was waitressing. I was running around so much because I was scared to death to take care of this baby on my own, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was scared. I was lonely. And, you know, I just remember getting thinner than I had ever been in my life. And that's when I really started turning to drugs and alcohol to deal with life.
Okay.
You know, every day after a shift, I would, you know what I mean, do the shot. I would drink until, you know what I mean, everybody else was ready to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously getting exposed to a lot of drugs, just partying all the time. And I didn't get, you know, back into the harder stuff until I was 21. I was really big into the rave scene at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So from the late 90s to the early 2000s, if you lived, you know, in Detroit metro area, there was, you know, a big rave scene. And, of course, there was ecstasy and methamphetamines and your classic club drugs. But there was also, you know, the underbelly of that current is a lot darker, and there is a lot more heroin and crack.
Okay.
So you might go to the rave, but then you go to the after club afterwards, and everybody is, you know, doing the harder stuff. That is where, you know, I really got addicted to heroin.
All
right. And so I got addicted to heroin at the age of 21.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just 5 years of hell.
Mm.
It was 5 years of jails, institutions, and overdoses.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I always had pain. You know, I had a disruption in my attachment to my parents.
Right.
So that started very, very early on in life. But the pain that I created from, you know, living that life was, you know, more than any human being can manage. And you just keep running.
Mm-hmm.
You just keep running. You know, you are stuck in a cycle. And, you know, some people could actually say with truth that when you are stuck in that life, that you are completely suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
Because any given day can be your last. And, you know, quite frankly, there are days that you probably want it to be your last more than anything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, I would have these moments, you know, I would have these moments where I would go to jail or I would go to rehab and I wouldn't be on any substance. And I would feel the pain of what I was doing to my son.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was out there running, you just keep running, 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 so you don't have to ever feel that pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it was those moments, you know, it was those, the culmination of those moments that finally, you know, made me turn, mm-hmm. you know, turn the corner. I remember the last time I was in jail, I was facing all kinds of criminal charges, and I had been doing very, very well. You know, I wish, you know what I mean, that, you know, recovery wasn't this long process, but for most people it is.
Mm-hmm.
We learn by default, by continuously trying to do it our own way until,
right.
you know, those of us who are blessed enough are finally humbled enough mm-hmm. to surrender. And I remember being in jail one time, and I was 25 years old, and I said, up until that point, I could always differentiate myself from other people because I didn't look like them. I was a very, you know what I mean, beautiful young lady.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly felt that I was more intelligent than most of the people that I interacted with.
Right.
And it was really in that moment where I was just facing all this trouble and I had just been doing so well and I found myself in the same position again that I clearly remember thinking to myself, you are exactly freaking like every person that's in here.
Oh, man.
You know, there is no difference. There is no difference between what you do and what these people do.
Right.
And you are going to be 30. I don't know why 30 was like, you know, now I look back and I'm like, 30 schmurdy, you know what I mean? But
at the time,
yeah.
At the time, 30 sounds really old. It's like, oh, no, oh, shit.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, you're going to be 30 years old, you know, and you're going to be doing this, you know, and your life is going to go by.
Mm-hmm.
And all that combined with just this pain that I felt from my son, because deep down inside of me, I knew that there was nobody that could love my son like me.
Mm-mm. No, he needed you just like you needed your father.
Yeah. And I knew that there was nobody that could love him or protect him, you know, like me. And so, and he was living with my parents, you know, the same environment that I, my mother and my stepfather, the same environment that I had fought so hard when I was a teenager.
Right.
So it's just the guilt and everything. And, you know, I love Brené Brown, and she, you know, speaks at length about the difference between guilt and shame.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, guilt is, she feels that guilt is important, because when we feel guilt, it motivates us to change, or at least that's what's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so guilt is, I did something bad, and shame is, I am bad.
Mm, right.
And for whatever reason, that last time when I was in jail, you know, I allowed my guilt, you know what I mean, to finally motivate me to change instead of just running from it, which is what I had been doing my whole life.
Right.
And I have to tell you this, you know, part of the story, because it's, you know, it's a very surreal part of my journey. When I first got arrested, I had been doing very, very well, as I've said several times. I left jail in 2004,
mm-hmm.
and I stayed clean for like 6 months, and I was living in a three-quarter house and going to therapy, and I was involved with a 12-step group, but I would not get rid of the loser boyfriend.
Okay.
And he relapsed, and it wasn't too long after he relapsed that I relapsed.
Oh, man.
And yes, and so I had been fighting a possession of cocaine charge because I did not want a felony on my record. And, you know, my lawyer, you know, felt that there was a very good chance that we would be able to fight the felony and get it reduced. So after I relapsed, I mean, I got hit with the mother load. I got hit with possession of stolen vehicle, fleeing and eluding, possession of cocaine, giving false information to a police officer. So here I am sitting in, you know, St. Clair, you know, Shores jail.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, how did I get here? How did I get from doing well to here? So they bring me over to the Macomb County Jail.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they have me there for a day, and they bring me up in the tower side, and then they call me back down to go in front of the judge.
Okay.
So I walk to, they bring me down to the bullpen to, for me to wait to go in front of the judge, and there's my dad. My dad is in the jail cell next to me, and I I haven't seen him in 2 years.
This is just entirely, at least what you might have thought was a coincidence at the time.
Yeah, well, his name is, you know, Danny Marcelli, and my name is Danielle Marcelli, so somewhere along the way might have got confused because we were both in there.
Okay.
My father had committed an armed robbery, and he was at, like, I think TRV. Don't quote me on that. I'm not sure where they brought him from, but they had to bring him back to the Macomb County Jail to tack on 2 years for the gun charge.
Okay.
So while we... You know, I look at him and I'm like, oh, my gosh, you know what I mean? Like, I haven't seen him in 2 years. I have all kinds of feelings about the situation. I tell him what's going on with me. And so they take him back, you know, either to TRV or back to the prison, you know, to wait. And he writes the judge a letter why he is, you know, there. And he says, you know, I was never there for Danielle her entire life, and I take great responsibility for the things that have happened to her. And I feel like her life would have been different if I, you know, would have been a father. So, interestingly enough, after that, each time that, like, we have a preliminary or final sentencing, he brought me and my father back together. And I think I understand now why he did that. Because... What the judge eventually did for me was he didn't give me any jail time, which is, you know, pretty crazy because I was on personal bond for a possession of cocaine, and then I caught all those other felonies. He gave me treatment again, but he gave my father 18 to 40 years.
Wow.
And that was double his guidelines for his crime. So what he essentially did was, you know what I mean, punish my father and gave me another opportunity. And I took that opportunity. You know, I took the opportunity. I got out and, you know, I changed my whole life. I had one relapse. I think I was out of jail, I don't know, maybe 6 months. And, you know, I got right back, you know what I mean, into the swing of things. I remember very clearly the day that that happened, because once again, I had, you know what I mean, a good footing, and I was moving forward, and I was gaining so many things back in my life. And then, you know what I mean, to be so impulsive again. And I remember very clearly, you know, getting down with all of the sincerity, you know, that I could ever have, and asking God to please, you know, remove this from my heart, remove it from my mind. I will do anything, you know, that you ask me to do to stay sober. And
okay.
I have stayed sober since that day.
That was the last time.
That was the last time. That
wow.
was the last time.
How long
and
ago was that, Danielle?
On Valentine's Day, it will be 11 years.
Phenomenal. Great job.
And so it's been such a journey since then. You know, in the very beginning, I was so humbled to just not be in jail. I mean, the reality of my father being sentenced to 18 to 40 years and the judge giving me another opportunity to, you know what I mean, make things right.
Right.
I was humbled and I was grateful and I was actually happy. I just think that when you've had everything stripped away from you, every little thing, you know what I mean, you appreciate.
I do. The equivalent of hitting rock bottom.
Yes. And even though, like, those first couple years in my recovery, I was so poor. And, you know, I got pregnant and I had to take with my husband, who was, you know what I mean, my boyfriend then. I had to take the bus everywhere pregnant. Our first apartment was a studio apartment, and then we got a two-bedroom apartment, and then we rented a house, and then we eventually bought a house. But every little step of the way, I was so happy. And grateful in those early years, and really, really engaged in, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after I had my last child, my husband and I had two children in recovery. She was about, I think, 7 or 8 weeks, and I decided to go back to school. I had gotten my GED when I was 19. Like I said, I started doing drugs at, you know what I mean, an early age and dropped out at
right.
16.
Sure.
So after I had my son, I got my GED. But I started thinking, you know, like a big girl. I started thinking, you know, I am going to have to be able to take care of myself.
Right.
You know, there's nobody in this world that, you know, is going to be able to take care of me but me. And if something happens to, you know, my husband, I need to be able to do this for me and my kids. So I went back to school, and that was very scary for me. I didn't know if I would be able to thrive in that environment, and it had been such a long time since I had gone to school. And I just did what I had been doing in recovery up till then. You know, I just kept showing up for my life every day. And
right.
I kept doing everything that I needed to do. You know, I studied. I showed up for class. And eventually I transferred from Macomb Community College over to Wayne State. And I entered into their social work program.
Okay.
And I continued to work very, very hard. You know, I graduated summa cum laude.
Good job.
With a 3.93 GPA. I was president
wow.
of the Honor Society.
Uh-huh.
I was the National Association of Social Workers Student of the Year.
Wow.
And I received nearly a full ride to Michigan State for graduate school.
No kidding. That's amazing.
Yes. So I went on to Michigan State, and I got my master's degree. I became very invested in the social work community. I sat on the board at the Wayne State School of Social Work. I was very, very active with their alumni association.
Mm-hmm.
I just stepped down off of that board last year because I've got a lot of other projects going on. But that taught me so much, that journey of going back to school after having dropped out of almost everything in my life from such a young age. It taught me so much about fear and how it's not real.
Right.
And, you know, self-esteem, and I learned how to organize my life, and, you know, I had so much drive. I still have so much drive. And, you know, school was such a wonderful thing for me for so many reasons, not just putting the dots together in life and, you know, having a greater understanding of the world around me, but it just taught me so much about me and what I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a really an amazing journey in recovery to go back to school. So since I've graduated, obviously, you know, my passion is addiction. So first job, I had an internship at Turning Point in Pontiac during graduate school, and they hired me. I was mm-hmm. there for 3 or 4 months, and, you know, and they hired me.
Mm-hmm.
And after being there for just like a year and a half, I became supervisor of their women's program. And that was very exciting because I got to develop their curriculum. And I wrote our women's specialty proposal. And these were all things that I was really wanting to gain knowledge of, develop skills. So it was a great first place for me mm-hmm. to start because they gave me so much autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And that you just, early on in your career, you know, that's invaluable.
Yes.
To have people, you know what I mean, give you that much autonomy and, you know, just to learn so much.
Mm. To have people believe in you like that is fantastic.
Absolutely. It was a wonderful experience, and I still have a very good relationship with the owner of Turning Point. But I wanted that, you know, Turning Point was a wonderful place for me to start. But from the beginning of my journey in recovery, I always knew that I wanted to work at Sacred Heart.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, the way that Higher Power laid out the cards, the house that we ended up, you know, purchasing was actually 15 minutes away from there. And, you know, we actually, you know, got that house on a fluke. It was because one of my husband's best friends had an arm on it, you know, back mm-hmm. when, you know, the whole economy pretty much crashed because of stuff like that.
Right.
And, you know, so his mortgage payment ballooned. And he wanted somebody to move in and rent it because he couldn't pay for it. Well, we were not willing to pay what he was asking, mm-hmm. but we agreed to pay a certain amount. And we ended up moving in, and he stopped making payments on the house, and we got to buy it. So even though it was near to the place that I always knew that I wanted to work, it was complete coincidence that, you know, we ended up out there. So, mm-hmm. I think a year after I started supervising the women's program at Turning Point, I started persistently submitting applications to Sacred Heart.
Okay.
And finally got in there February of 2015. So I am a primary therapist there. And, you know, we specialize in co-occurring.
Mm-hmm.
So I deal with, you know, both the mental health aspect and substance abuse.
Okay.
But probably the most exciting thing I love what I do. So, I mean, I'm there's never a day that I wake up and I am, like, bummed out to go to work.
Right.
Because it's a calling to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, I'm called to do it. It's not a job.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I am working with a very passionate group of people to establish the first recovery high school here in Michigan. So I don't know if you know a lot about recovery high schools.
No, I don't. Tell me a little bit.
So we have known for a long time in the field of addiction that, you know, peer support is critical. And, you know, that is for substance abuse as well as mental health. Just having
right.
that solidarity, the, you know, the therapeutic value of one addict or alcoholic helping another is mm-hmm. unparalleled. So we've known that for a long time. But for teenagers, it's 10,000 fold.
Okay.
You know, it's absolutely necessary to create an environment where, you know what I mean, they have that peer support. And right now there's about 35 recovery high schools across the country. Texas is pretty much the model state for peer recovery groups. You know, some of the first recovery collegiate peer groups were established in Texas, and they have three recovery high schools there. So they are creating a model for the rest of the country. And I can definitely send you, you know, information on that if you're interested. But
I am. Please do.
It's there's a lot of people that are very passionate about making this happen. And we were working with the school district where I live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we already have a strategic plan, and, you know, we've had a lot of things put in place. Unfortunately, the school district, because there's two ways that you can establish a recovery high school. One is a
mm-hmm.
charter,
mm-hmm.
or one is using the infrastructure of the public education that's already
okay.
put in place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's obviously the more ideal way, because if you have kids with special needs, they can access those resources.
Sure.
So we had a district that was already willing to work with us, and, you know what I mean, we had a date to present to the board. And unfortunately, the superintendent pulled out.
Oh,
so,
no.
But it doesn't stop there. We have money that's being allocated from the Michigan Department of Health. So we are going to the ISD. And
say that again. What?
We're going to the Intermediate School District.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, as of right now, it is probably going to begin as, you know, outreach and prevention.
Okay.
But there's so many people that are involved with this that are so incredibly passionate and so knowledgeable that, you know, it's more like it's going to happen.
Right.
When it's, you know, when it's going to happen, you know, it's going to happen at the right time. But I know that, you know what I mean, we're all advocating and networking and educating people, and very excited about the entire process.
No, I can see why. And you're right. It will happen when and how it's supposed to, and we don't always have to know that.
Yeah. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
That's amazing. You've been through so much, Danielle. Thank you for sharing it.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, people hearing stories like this, people who are in the middle of, you know, dealing with it, can get so much hope from hearing how well things can turn out if you just keep going.
Absolutely. And I am very passionate about helping people. You know, over the years working with people inside, you know, the program and therapeutically in my profession, I have heard so many stories. I have heard so much, you know, and for me to be able to be there for that person,
mm-hmm.
Just to be, you know, a light in the dark just to, you know, provide them some hope.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's any other job in the world that would fulfill me as much as what I do every single day.